please be seated. All right, the next matter on calendar is docket number 59858, Brady versus Bank of America. You'll notice Justice Hardesty isn't with us today. He had an unavoidable conflict in his schedule. He couldn't get down here. He will be listening to the webcast, and he will be fully participating in the deliberations. So with that, counsel, I'll let you begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you very much, Justices, for allowing me to present the case on behalf of my client. This case started pretty much like any other civil case. I filed a complaint, which is nothing more or less than a series of allegations based on information received from my client. The responsive pleadings in this case were not answers, but were motions to dismiss. We opposed the motions to dismiss, and we provided extensive documentation regarding our respective positions to each of the defendants. When we went to the hearing, the court granted the motions and issued an order, and that's what we're appealing from. Now, the court's order, in my understanding, when we went to the hearing, was that the basis for a motion to dismiss would be that the court should consider my complaint, our allegations, in other words, what we say, as true, and view them in the light most favorable to my clients, which are Ron Brady and Premier Management. And in order to bring the motions, after having made that, or looking at the complaint in that way, the court has to find that there's no genuine issue of material fact. Oddly enough, the court's order doesn't even address that. Now, what the court's order does address is whether or not we should have received court permission from the receivership court before proceeding against the receiver. And then essentially, the court uses that as a basis, the district court uses that as a basis to dismiss out all the other clients. So I'd like to address the receiver first. Now, in drafting the complaint, we of course were aware that the receivership has the receiver has a special sort of status. It's got qualified immunity, and in order to proceed against the receiver in both his individual capacity and as the receiver, we knew that we were going to have to establish, without getting court permission, that he had acted outside the scope of his receivership. Now, the allegations that were contained in our complaint with respect to the receiver were that he did operate outside, that he did, in the course of the receivership and settling and doing, he did act outside the scope of the receivership. And we relied on the Ames case, Ames versus Crown, which says nothing more or less that as a general rule, not even a hard and fast rule, but as a general rule, you can't sue the receiver unless you get the receiver court permission, unless you make the allegation, and of course you make allegations in your complaint, you make the allegation that the receiver acted outside the scope of the receivership, and then court permission is not necessary. Now, we alleged several things in our complaint that were outside the scope of the receivership. Probably the most notable was the issue regarding the lease. Now, it's important to note that my client, Ron Brady, was the owner of this property, having purchased it from the Herradas in 2004. And that was a long time before these foreclosure proceedings. Property was quitclaim to him. He assumed ownership of it. It was in a state of disrepair. He invested in terms of money and toil approximately $500,000. He turned the place around. It was turning a profit. And the Herradas decided that maybe they didn't want to give it up for the small amount that they had agreed to. That's the subject of a separate lawsuit. What happened was, early on, when he assumed ownership, he created a lease. He leased a portion of the property that he owned to a company, which is a company, a Nevada corporation in good standing, that he is the officer of, the president of. And that company is Premier Management. Premier Management received a 10-year lease from the owner, Ron Brady, for the purpose of storing tools, equipment, vehicles, tools, all of which were used by Premier Management to effectuate the services they perform. Now, Premier Management is an operation that does maintenance at not just the apartment complex in question here, but at other ones as well. And so he leased this property to Premier Management so they could store the vehicles, store the tools. He had a locked storage center, two huge portable storage centers. His vehicles were on the property and so forth. Now, when the property eventually came into foreclosure and the receiver was appointed, the receiver locked Mr. Brady out of Premier Management's property, sitting on the property that was leased to Premier Management. Mr. Brady showed the receiver the lease, said, "Here is the lease," and the receiver did not do anything. Now, it's the receiver's obligation, we quoted the cases in our answering brief, when there's a modification, when there's a third party, when something changes, because don't forget, in this other lawsuit, or in the receivership order, the only plaintiff named with respect to my client is Brian Brady, not Premier Management. Now when the receiver is informed that he has another party, in addition to Brady, he has Premier Management, it's the receiver's responsibility to go to the court and seek modification of the order. In fact, the order recording, the order appointing the receiver specifically says that if he becomes aware of a modification, and certainly this lease would have brought in a third party, Premier Management, he should have gone to the court to seek modification of the order, but he didn't do that. Instead, what he did was he ignored the lease. He never brought the lease into the receivership court, and he essentially evicted Ron Brady and Premier from the property that they leased without going to any court or to anybody. Now, that's just one of the things that we allege the receiver did, but in and of itself, that would be enough. It's outside the scope not only of his responsibilities as a receiver, but it's also outside the scope of the order appointing the receiver. So, making that allegation alone, based on my review of the Ames case, would give us, you know, the right to sue the receiver without seeking the receivership court's permission. He's acting outside not only the receivership's order, but the scope of the receivership. After all, the receiver's supposed to be a neutral party. And in our complaint, we are alleging he was not a neutral party, that he was acting at the behest of Bank of America, that he was informed that my client would be uncooperative, and that he took steps outside the scope of his receivership that resulted in the destruction of my client's property.
Let me ask you this, and there's a whole lot of very interesting issues in this case, a lot of them. But cutting this down to its very simplest element, what do you want? Essentially, you're indicating that procedurally the judge erred in this case by treating this motion to dismiss essentially as a summary judgment and not giving you an opportunity to properly respond and making determinations that seem to be factual in nature and that there are genuine issues of material fact.
Yes, and what I want is an opportunity to proceed with this lawsuit. Nothing more, nothing less. I don't think anything that the... I wanted to focus on the receiver because he's in sort of a different position than everybody else. Everybody else is just saying, look, there's no genuine issue of material fact here. Even if these things happened, it wasn't our fault. But the fact of the matter is, what the defendants say is their defense. You know, what we say are our allegations. What they say is their defense. Nothing, raising a defense doesn't rise to the level of a finding that there's no genuine issue of material fact. What I want is the opportunity to proceed with the lawsuit. What the judge did was cut my client off at the knees, even before we got into discovery. So the answer to the question is, I want the case remanded at the district court and the opportunity to go forward. Justices, as I said, the other part of the order with respect to Bank of America, I really don't understand the judge's ruling with that. What the district court judge said was, all of these dismissals were without prejudice. And what the district court said, look, if you're going to proceed against Bank of America, you've got to come back to this court, not the receivership court, but this court, and get permission to proceed against Bank of America. And then, the way I read the order, everything is hinged on me having to go or plaintiff having to go to the receivership court, get permission to sue the receiver, go back to the district court, get permission to sue Bank of America. On what basis, I'm not sure, because it's not elicited in the order. And then I can come back and file a suit against everybody else. But putting all that aside for the moment, and the deficiency of the order, where there are no findings, where there is no mention of even the standard that she was supposed to use to review these motions, putting all that aside, anything that the defendants say in their answering briefs or anything that they said in their motions, well, that's their defense. That's what defendants do. Plaintiffs make allegations and defendants make defenses. And unless they can show there's no genuine issue of material fact, assuming everything in our complaint is true and viewing them in the light most favorable to us, the motion should never have been granted.
So when the arguments, you're arguing the summary judgment standard, when that's not the standard for 12b-5.
Well, it's similar enough, I think, Justice Fury, that I can make the argument. I mean, a 12b-5 motion at this stage in the proceedings, with nothing more than a complaint and motions being filed, the judge has got to look at the record and say, Schwartz, you don't have a cause of action. I mean, that's the only way she can dismiss it. And she didn't even say that in the order.
Well, she was kind of saying jurisdictionally you shouldn't be there.
That's true. And I believe she was incorrect in that ruling for the reasons that I've related with respect to the receiver.
And you're saying that's all tied to genuine issues of material fact?
Yes. And there are. Most of the issues we're alleging are all hotly disputed. I think you can see that by the responses and by what the respondents say in their responses to our appeal.
Is there anything in the record that shows that she actually stated that this was treated as a motion for summary judgment rather than a motion to dismiss?
Well, I'm not certain that she ever addressed that, but I specifically asked her about it. When she granted the motion to dismiss, and we included this in our answering brief, I did say, so judge, is what you're saying, I didn't raise any issues of genuine material fact, and she said, no, I'm not saying that. And I said, well, then what's the basis for dismissing all of these complaints, or dismissing my complaint with respect to each and every one of the plaintiffs? I mean, not everybody was in the position, the special position that the receiver was in. Arguably, the receiver is in a special position because arguably I should have had to go to the receivership court to get permission. But that doesn't apply to any of the other defendants. So how are motions granted unless there's a finding that there's no genuine issue of material fact? What is the other basis?
Well, then there was a significant amount of material that was presented to support the motions and defend the motion that were outside the pleadings.
Well, that's true, but as I said, Justice Perry, I mean, you know, defendants raise defenses. That's what they do. That doesn't mean that my complaint shouldn't be allowed to go forward in the district court, and it should, and that's what I'm asking for. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Sure, you've got about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Will Miller, and I represent Dotan Lek and United AMS, the receiver in this action, and I have Dotan with me as well. Since there are three other respondents, I'll try to quickly and briefly answer all of your questions and go through our arguments in response to the opening brief. Now here, appellants needed to and failed to seek permission to file against the receiver in the receivership court. This is clear in the Nevada law, and this is clear in the Ames court when this court held that. The reasons why this should be the law and this reason why this is the law are threefold. One, to avoid forum shopping. Obviously, it appears appellants were unsatisfied with rulings from the receivership court and thus decided to pursue another action with another judge while the receivership court had jurisdiction over this.
But do you agree or disagree that if there's an allegation that the receiver is acting outside bounds of the receivership, then you don't need to do that?
If the receiver acted outside the scope, then you can do this. But here, the receiver didn't act outside the scope.
Isn't that a factual determination? How do we know?
Because the receiver was discharged from its duties and was terminated after the foreclosure sale. And because the receiver was discharged, the receiver said, you acted in good faith.
But there are also allegations that they were presented with significant indications that there were personal property on the premises and that the receiver elected to ignore many warnings that there were personal property on the premises and not to dispose of anything. And so why wouldn't that be a factual determination?
Well, the order granting the appointment of the receivership said it would take possession of the property and the assets thereof. And that's what the receiver did. And for that matter, a lot of the allegations happened when the receivership action was going on between, I believe it was March of 2009.
Right, but there was also a lot of activity that these weren't assets of that property. There were receipts given, all kinds of little indications that, you know, this property isn't related.
And again, I would have to argue that between the receivership time, the receivership court is the most knowledgeable about the underlying action and why it appointed the receiver and why it discharged the receiver. And if it's during that allegation, why would another district court judge have to essentially go in and overrule another district court judge's order, either ordering the receiver and then terminating
the receiver? But if the receiver is acting outside the bounds of the receivership, that's not an issue.
And I would submit, again, that the receiver didn't act outside the issue.
What about the dismissal to the other parties? What's that got to do with the receiver?
Dismissal to the other parties?
Yes.
I believe right now with the receiver, you have to go to the receivership court to answer that. With the other parties, I believe a lot of the allegations are tied into the receiver, and I would argue that the district court judge and Judge Hardcastle properly dismissed all the parties and held that the Judge Gonzalez should hear everything with that.
So that's actually what she was ruling, is that everything should be in front of the receivership court. Why didn't she just transfer everything to the receivership court?
And
it would have been the easiest thing to do, and then
I
litigated this and really got a final disposition.
I agree with that, and more than that, the law firm also, Judge Hardcastle, said that. She dismissed all the claims without prejudice and said go back to the receivership court. And the easy thing would be to go to the receivership court. Instead of that, he filed this notice of appeal. So the judge never cut off his knees or anything at this stage. She just said, here's another avenue, and here's the proper mechanism, and the judge, Judge Gonzalez, was the proper place to argue this action and then to litigate this matter. As we've stated in our answer and briefly, the court properly dismissed the claims against the receiver for the three reasons we discussed. The one would be, one, the appellant failed to obtain leave from Judge Gonzalez. Two, the receiver holds derived judicial immunity, and then we set forth that pretty clearly in our answer and brief. And then three, the receiver is not personally liable for acts taken as a receiver and can't be held personally liable. We've set forth all the arguments in there, and if you have any questions, I could answer them. The bottom line is, pursuant to the general rule in Ames, which should be applicable here, the receiver, the only cause of action against the receiver should have been in Judge Gonzalez's. And just really briefly, Justices, I know we've, in our appellant brief, or in our answering brief, we asked for sanctions. And the only reason we asked for sanctions is, Ames was clear that you should have gone to receiver court. Judge Hardcastle dismissed the claims and said go to the receiver court. Instead of that, the appellants filed a non-conforming brief. For instance, the brief is not concise and may raise many irrelevant and immaterial issues. They have a 19-page discussion of facts and case record, unsupported by any citations to the record, a 6-page conclusion with block quotes. The opening brief contains numerous block quotes, irrelevant discussions, and the reply brief is very similar. They also failed to include in the opening brief a disclosure statement, a jurisdictional statement, and a summary of the argument, and therefore we simply request, and this is the reason why we request, sanctions pursuant to Rule 28 and 28.2.
But shouldn't have Judge Hardcastle at least allowed the discovery to show whether or not the receiver acted outside the receivership so that Ames would apply, or that he would have to go to the receivership court? You wouldn't.
I believe at this stage, and when you said before, Judge Gonzalez has the most knowledge, and the receiver should have gone over, the appellant should have gone there. And at that point, I think she said, Judge Gonzalez had the most knowledge, so let's have Judge Gonzalez hear everything.
Well, and I guess the issue, for me anyway, is if this was treated as a summary judgment, was there any 56 application made to continue so that discovery could be had? Was any request
I don't know if there was any 56F request. especially because these were motions to dismiss, but I don't believe they were 56F.
Right, but as I said, they were treated as a motion for summary judgment.
Yes, but I don't believe they were in 56F.
Okay.
For those reasons, we simply request that this court affirm the order and rule that appellant's complaint was rightfully dismissed, and this court should award reasonable attorney's fees against the appellant's attorney pursuant to Rule 28 and 20.2.
Could you address one more issue on Bank of America and the dismissal of those claims? Okay, that's going to be addressed. Oh, okay. All right. So you're splitting up your time.
Yes.
Okay. So you're done.
Thank you, Justice.
All right.
Good morning, Justice. My name is Michael Stein. Here with me is Casey Perkins about Burlington Substantial Author Ralph Reed. Justices, I heard Mr. Schwartz answer a question to you, and he said he wants to proceed with the case. The plaintiff did have the opportunity to proceed with this case by the district court. The trial court told him, with respect to the Bank of America, in dismissing your case because you won't allege any facts with respect to Bank of America to support any of those 8 claims for relief. By doing it, we have prejudice. However, since you received the motion to dismiss and chose not to file an amended complaint, which he could have done without leave of court, the judge wanted him to bring something to her in the form of a motion to show that he had gotten some facts to go forward against Bank of America. But he chose not to do that. Now, when he filed his brief with this court, the plaintiff, or the appellant, failed to file a jurisdictional statement. And we pointed that out to the court and objected for that. Now, I have to be honest with the court because I missed something in our briefing. But it's something that is not lost for failure to bring it because jurisdiction is never waived. Specifically, the district court's order granting dismissal as to be available without prejudice and therefore doesn't constitute an appealable order under NRAP 3AB and Brown v. MHC Stagecoach, 129 Nevada Advance Opinion 37. This case only came out in May of 2013. Now, it wasn't until I was preparing for oral argument that I made these connections. I stumbled across this Brown case. And then I looked at federal case law interpreting the exact same rule, although in federal court it's a different rule, number called B6 instead of 12B5. And in those cases that I reviewed, I learned my suspicions were correct, that when a plaintiff's case has been dismissed without prejudice, the plaintiff has two choices, to amend as suggested by the court, or to notify the trial court that they're going to stand on that plea and get a final order so that it is appealable. And I felt as an officer of the court that I had to bring this to the court's attention.
Did you submit any supplemental authorities to the clerk?
I just started drafting it, Your Honor, and I'm going to file a motion with the court on this issue. Again, jurisdiction is never raised, and I apologize that I just didn't put the pieces together. I knew there was something there intuitively when we didn't see a jurisdictional statement, but I didn't put it together until yesterday. With that said, I need to deal with the analysis, and with respect to Bank of America, it's very straightforward. Judge Hardcastle said, with respect to BOA, you have not alleged any facts against BOA to make them liable on any of these 8 claims. Let's remember here that BOA never controlled the property and never controlled the receiver. And even if, as plaintiff alleges, his lawyer told him, plaintiff's lawyer told plaintiff, that he heard either from the receiver or BOA or somebody, that BOA's position was that it's possible that the property was bought with rent money, their secured collateral. That doesn't give rise to a claim for relief on any of those 8 claims. All it means is that's what they thought. And it was clear that the receiver's job and what the receiver was doing from the very documents provided by plaintiff was determining who owned that property, that personal property. That is his job. But at no time do we, Bank of America, control this court-appointed receiver? And even if we had directed him to do something, under the Jackson case, I don't believe, that's not enough to bring liability. And let's not forget that the plaintiff himself admits he was directing the receiver what he wanted the receiver to do.
And nobody paid Bank of America, that's why they foreclosed. Is that correct?
That's correct. After all those bizarre transactions between the Moradas and Mr. Brady, and the bankruptcies all fell away, Moradas and Brady got into their own nasty lawsuit, and Brady stopped making payments, and the Moradas stopped making payments.
One quick question with regard to a couple of claims that were dismissed. I'm concerned about the conversion claim and the tortious interference claim. And tell me why those claims don't survive.
Well, we never had, well, first of all, there's no facts to say that we met any of those elements. But the conversion claim, we never
they
had.
They alleged that BofA had indicated the property that they purchased through the proceeds from the apartment complex, which halted essentially the return of the personal property. And so I'm
Again, what he claims that he heard from his lawyer, who heard from someone else, is that B of A took a position that that property might belong to, might have been bought with this. But that's what the receiver's job is to do. The receiver comes on the property. It's an apartment complex. There's these giant metal storage things. There's trucks.
Right.
There's the storage shed, and some guys say, it's all mine.
Right.
Well, you would expect that receiver to say, look, prove it. And in the documentation provided by plaintiff, including some email from his lawyer, he said, look, the judge said, try to work it out between you, but if you can't, come back to the court. Amazingly, Brady never went to Judge Hardcastle and said, Your Honor, I move for an order that my property be released. Here are my receipts to prove it. Okay. But what did happen is he was given opportunities.
I think that answered my question, and I think we're going to
thank you, Justice. I appreciate it.
Give you other counsel the opportunity to make his case. And
thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Justices. Jeff McDavid appearing on behalf of DLS. Your Honor, I'm going to address a couple points very quickly because we have a lot of time. First of all, let's talk about the lease itself. The claims that are made and the reason that he does not have facts that will ever give rise to a cause of action at this stage is because the lease was extinguished. And the court's order is not so much that it's jurisdictional bound by there's not enough controversy over $10,000 as the panel alleges in his brief. That's incorrect. What actually happened is that the court is sending him back and saying, go to the receiver court because your lease has been extinguished. Now, for a moment, take a look at that, because that's what his claims are all based on, is that the lease itself that he signed with himself, his own company, and he signs it as the landlord and the tenant, he signs that lease, which gets extinguished at foreclosure sale. And there is no dispute. The law is clear. At the time the Bank of America forecloses on its deed of trust, it foreclosed and wiped out and extinguished any junior liens, any claims that were subordinate to its claims. In fact, here is a copy, and it's two plaintiffs, I'm sorry, appellant's appendix, which is document number 307, which is the lease agreement. The lease agreement, paragraph 23, states subordination. This rental agreement is hereby expressly made subject and subordinate in all respects to all mortgage deeds or trust and assignments of rents. He took it. In other words, he signed his own lease subordinate to the deed of trust, which was wiped out and extinguished at the time of the foreclosure sale. Bank of America forecloses and then sells it months later to my client, DLSRP. Now, DLS takes it as a bona fide purchaser. There is no dispute that DLS purchased the property for valuable consideration from Bank of America. It's an investor. It was on the market and purchased the property. It also did not take it to any notice of any claim of this lease by Mr. Brady. Mr. Brady admittedly never, I'll
finish. I'll give you an extra minute.
Thank you very much. He never records the lease, never puts anybody on notice in terms of DLS, and in fact concedes in his briefs that Bank of America and the receiver, quote, acted in bad faith by not disclosing to the buyer the existence of this lease. So you have an unrecorded lease that was extinguished at the time of foreclosure. You have a bona fide purchaser and DLS who bought it in good faith as bona fide purchaser for valuable consideration and without notice. So all those claims, the negligence per se, breach of contract, breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, wrongful termination, wrongful eviction, all of those are all based on the lease. And what the court ruled was, go back to the receiver court, and if for somehow you can get this extinguished lease acknowledged, that it survived foreclosure, and it survived the sale against to DLS, then you can bring back your claims against DLS. Because right now, your claims are all based on that lease. And being based on that lease, you have no claim.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I gave Mr. Ben-David extra minutes, so I'll add a minute to yours as well.
Oh, thank you very much, Justice Ben-David. What I'm listening to here are some very, very fine attorneys make very, very persuasive arguments about the merits of their respective case. But they haven't raised, or they haven't, those arguments don't rise to the level of my complaint having no genuine issue of material fact. Now, I'm not familiar with the case that was cited by counsel, so I'll be looking forward to getting his supplemental brief. I can't address it right now because I'm not familiar with it. But the district court makes an order, and I get to appeal it. I mean, the district court judge is not a dictator. The district court judge says, here's my order, and I get to file an appeal. That's why we have the Supreme Court. I didn't do anything wrong. Even if there are alternatives to what I could have done, I suppose I could have filed a motion for reconsideration, or I could have done X, Y, or Z. The fact of the matter is, what I decided to do is file this appeal, and there was nothing improper about that. One brief statement with regard to the jurisdictional statement. Yes, it's missing. That was an error. To impugn or to suggest a nefarious motive for that, I find it very insulting. And I'm just going to go on, unless you have any more questions about that. But let's listen to what we're hearing. DSL, who threw away the property, by the way, is saying we're not responsible because the lease was voided. Well, according to whom? It's never been adjudicated by any court. It wasn't even adjudicated by Judge Hardcastle. She said, go test the validity of the lease. Nobody said it's adjudicated, but even if it was, DSL was on notice because my client filed a notice of personal property on the premises 2 or 3 months before DSL bought. I heard Bank of America come in here and say, we didn't do anything, and even if we did, the receiver's in charge of the property. But Bank of America had this receiver appointed, and that is in our exhibits to the opposition to the motion to dismiss. This guy is their receiver. And it is our position that the Bank of America informed him, the receiver, that property doesn't belong to Premier, it doesn't belong to Brady, it was purchased with proceeds of running the apartment complex, and that makes them liable.
Why didn't you go back to Gonzalez on this? Once Hardcastle gave you that, she gave you a tell, what I call a tell.
Because,
go back to Gonzalez and you can litigate this case.
And Justice Cherry, the reason I didn't is because of the Ains case. Because the Ains case is not crystal clear for the proposition that I have to go to the receivership court. In fact, it is just the opposite. All the Ains case says is, look, here's the general rule. Now, if you make an allegation in your complaint, and that's what it says, an allegation in your complaint.
But you understand why Ains is saying that? Ains is saying that because the person who has the most knowledge about this, and I've been a receiver, and I've appointed receivers, is the receiver court. Gonzalez knows exactly what has happened, otherwise she wouldn't have appointed a receiver.
Well, if anybody
would have been better off, that's my own belief.
Well, I'm not saying I couldn't have done that. I'm just saying that based on my review of this court's precedent, I didn't have to do that, so I didn't. And the receiver, by the way, with all due respect, when he was informed that there was a third party, Premier Management out there, when he was informed that there was this lease, well, his order appointing him requires him to go to Judge Gonzalez and say, look, we need a modification of the receivership. There's another party out there. There's a lease out there. The receiver has to do it by the court's order and did not.
All right. Very good. Yeah, my understanding is that you're going to supply the supplemental briefing on the jurisdiction issue that you presented, and I'll give counsel an opportunity to look at it and respond.
Yes, Justices, I will file that the latest tomorrow, but probably today, and we will serve in conformity with the rules.
Very good.
All right. 10 days to respond?
Yeah. All right. Good.
Thank
Thank you.
Good day, Ms. Pye.
Thank you, counsel, for the briefs and the argument today.
But I had a minute allocated. Could I use 30 seconds of that?
You had what?
For Norton Consulting Investigation.
I didn't hear any divvying up of time, so I'm not going to do that today. And this matter stands submitted. We'll stand in recess until 11:30.